An Introduction to the Book of Job by G.K. Chesterton. The Book of Job is among the other Old Testament books both a philosophical riddle and a historical riddle. It is the philosophical riddle that concerns us in such an introduction as this, so we may dismiss first the few words of general explanation or warning which should be said about the historical aspect. Controversy has long raged about which parts of this epic belong to its original scheme and which are interpolations of considerably later date. The doctors disagree, as it is the business of doctors to do, but upon the whole, the trend of investigation has always been in the direction of maintaining that the parts interpolated, if any, were the prose prologue and epilogue, and possibly the speech of the young man, who comes in with an apology at the end. I do not profess to be competent to decide such questions, but whatever decision the reader may come to concerning them, there is a general truth to be remembered in this connection. When you deal with any ancient artistic creation, do not suppose that it is anything against it that it grew gradually. The Book of Job may have grown gradually, just as Westminster Abbey grew gradually. But the people who made the old folk poetry, like the people who made Westminster Abbey, did not attach that importance to the actual date and the actual author, that importance which is entirely the creation of the almost insane individualism of modern times. We may put aside the case of Job as one complicated with religious difficulties, and take any other, say the case of the Iliad. Many people have maintained the characteristic formula of modern skepticism, that Homer was not written by Homer, but by another person of the same name. Just in the same way, many have maintained that Moses was not Moses, but another person called Moses. But the thing really to be remembered in the matter of the Iliad is that if other people did interpolate the passages, the thing did not create the same sense of shock as would be created by such proceedings in these individualistic times. The creation of the tribal epic was to some extent regarded as a tribal work, like the building of the tribal temple. Believe then, if you will, that the prologue of Job and the epilogue and the speech of Elihu are things inserted after the original work was composed. But do not suppose that such insertions have that obvious and spurious character which would belong to any insertions in a modern individualistic book. Do not regard the insertions as you would regard a chapter in George Meredith, which you afterwards found had not been written by George Meredith, or half a scene in Ibsen, which you had found had been cunningly sneaked in by Mr. William Archer. Remember that this old world, which made these old poems, like the Iliad and Job, always kept the tradition of what it was making. A man could almost leave a poem to his son to be finished as he would have finished it, just as a man could have left a field to his son, to be reaped as he would have reaped it. What is called Homeric unity may be a fact or not. The Iliad may have been written by one man, it may have been written by 100 men, but let us remember that there was more unity in those times in 100 men than there is unity now in one man. Then a city was like one man. Now a man is like a city in a civil war. Without going, therefore, into questions of unity as understood by the scholars, we may say of the scholarly riddle that the book has unity in the sense that all great traditional creations have unity, in the sense that Canterbury Cathedral has unity. And the same is broadly true of what I have called the philosophical riddle. There is a real sense in which the Book of Job stands apart from most of the books included in the canon of the Old Testament. But here again, those are wrong who maintain that the Old Testament is a mere loose library, that it has no consistency or aim. Whether the result was achieved by some supernatural spiritual truth, or by a steady national tradition, or merely by an ingenious selection in after times, the books of the Old Testament have a quite perceptible unity. To attempt to understand the Old Testament without realizing this main idea is as absurd as it would be to study one of Shakespeare's plays without realizing that the author of them had any philosophical object at all. It is as if a man were to read the history of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, thinking all the time that he was reading what really purported to be the history of an old Danish pirate prince. Such a reader would not realize at all that Hamlet's procrastination was on the part of the poet intentional. He would merely say, "How long Shakespeare's hero does take to kill his enemy." So speak the Bible smashers, who are unfortunately always at bottom Bible worshippers. They do not understand the special tone and intention of the Old Testament. They do not understand its main idea, which is the idea of all men being merely the instruments of a higher power. Those, for instance, who complain of the atrocities and treacheries of the judges and prophets of Israel, have really got a notion in their head that has nothing to do with the subject. They are too Christian. They are reading back into the pre-Christian scriptures a purely Christian idea. The idea of saints, the idea that the chief instruments of God are very particularly good men. This is a deeper, a more daring, and a more interesting idea than the old Jewish one. It is the idea that innocence has about it something terrible, which in the long run makes and remakes empires in the world. But the Old Testament idea was much more what might be called the common sense idea, that strength is strength, that cunning is cunning, that worldly success is worldly success, and that Jehovah uses these things for his own ultimate purpose, just as he uses natural forces or physical elements. He uses the strength of a hero as he uses that of a mammoth without any particular respect for the mammoth. I cannot comprehend how it is that so many simple-minded skeptics have read such stories as the fraud of Jacob and suppose that the man who wrote it, whoever he was, did not know that Jacob was a sneak just as well as we do. The primeval human sense of honor does not change so much as that. But these simple-minded skeptics are, like the majority of modern skeptics, Christians. They fancy that the patriarchs must be meant for patterns. They fancy that Jacob was being set up as some kind of saint. And in that case, I do not wonder that they are a little startled. That is not the atmosphere of the Old Testament at all. The heroes of the Old Testament are not the sons of God, but the slaves of God. Gigantic and terrible slaves like the genie, who were the slaves of Aladdin. The central idea of the great part of the Old Testament may be called the idea of the loneliness of God. God is not the only chief character of the Old Testament. God is properly the only character in the Old Testament. Compared with his clearness of purpose, all the other wills are heavy and automatic, like those of animals. Compared with his actuality, all the sons of flesh are shadows. Again and again the note is struck, with whom hath he taken counsel? I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the peoples there was no man with me. All the patriarchs and prophets are merely his tools or weapons, for the Lord is a man of war. He uses Joshua like an axe or Moses like a measuring rod. For him Samson is only a sword and Isaiah a trumpet. The saints of Christianity are supposed to be like God, to be, as it were, little statuettes of him. The Old Testament hero is no more supposed to be of the same stature as God than a saw or a hammer is supposed to be of the same shape as the carpenter. This is the main key and characteristic of the Hebrew Scriptures as a whole. There are, indeed, in those Scriptures innumerable instances of the sort of rugged humor, keen emotion, and powerful individuality, which is never wanting in great primitive prose and poetry. Nevertheless, the main characteristic remains. The sense is not merely that God is stronger than man, not merely that God is more secret than man, but that he means more, that he knows better what he is doing, that compared with him we have something of the vagueness, the unreason, and the vagrancy of the beasts that perish. It is he that sitteth above the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. We might almost put it thus. The book is so intent upon asserting the personality of God that it almost asserts the impersonality of man. Unless this gigantic cosmic brain has conceived a thing, the thing is insecure and void. Man has not enough tenacity to ensure its continuance. Except the Lord build the house, their labor is but lost that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman watcheth but in vain. Everywhere else, then, the Old Testament positively rejoices in the obliteration of man in comparison with the divine purpose. The book of Job stands definitely alone because the book of Job definitely asks, but what is the purpose of God? Is it worth the sacrifice even of our miserable humanity? Of course it is easy enough to wipe out our own paltry wills for the sake of a will that is grander and kinder. But is it grander and kinder? Let God use his tools, let God break his tools. But what is he doing, and what are they being broken for? It is because of this question that we have to attack as a philosophical riddle, the riddle of the Book of Job. The present importance of the Book of Job cannot be expressed adequately even by saying that it is the most interesting of ancient books. We may almost say of the Book of Job that it is the most interesting of modern books. In truth, of course, neither of the two phrases covers the matter because fundamental human religion and fundamental human irreligion are both at once old and new. Philosophy is either eternal or it is not philosophy. The modern habit of saying, "This is my opinion, but I may be wrong," is entirely irrational. If I say that it may be wrong, I say that it is not my opinion. The modern habit of saying, "Every man has a different philosophy, this is my philosophy and it suits me," the habit of saying this is mere weak-mindedness. A cosmic philosophy is not constructed to fit a man. A cosmic philosophy is constructed to fit a cosmos. A man can no more possess a private religion than he can possess a private sun and moon. The first of the intellectual beauties of the Book of Job is that it is all concerned with this desire to know the actuality, the desire to know what is, and not merely what seems. If moderns were writing the book, we should probably find that Job and his comforters got on quite well together by the simple operation of referring their differences to what is called the temperament, saying that the comforters were by nature optimists, and Job by nature a pessimist. and they would be quite comfortable, as people can often be, for some time at least, by agreeing to say what is obviously untrue. For if the word pessimist means anything at all, then emphatically, Job is not a pessimist. His case alone is sufficient to refute the modern absurdity of referring everything to physical temperament. Job does not in any sense look at life in a gloomy way. If wishing to be happy, and being quite ready to be happy, constitute an optimist, Job is an optimist. He is a perplexed optimist. He is an exasperated optimist. He is an outraged and insulted optimist. He wishes the universe to justify itself, not because he wishes it to be caught out, but because he really wishes it to be justified. He demands an explanation from God, but he does not do it at all in the spirit in which Hampden might demand an explanation from Charles I. He does it in the spirit in which a wife might demand an explanation from her husband whom she really respected. He remonstrates with his Maker because he is proud of his Maker. He even speaks of the Almighty as his enemy, but he never doubts, at the back of his mind, that his enemy has some kind of case which he does not understand. In a fine and famous blasphemy, he says, "Oh, that mine adversary had written a book!" It never really occurs to him that it could possibly be a bad book. He is anxious to be convinced. That is, he thinks that God could convince him. In short, we may say again that if the word optimist means anything, which I doubt, Job is an optimist. He shakes the pillars of the world and strikes insanely at the heavens. He lashes the stars. But it is not to silence them. It is to make them speak. In the same way, we may speak of the official optimists, the comforters of Job. Again, if the word pessimist means anything, which I doubt, the comforters of Job may be called pessimists rather than optimists. All that they really believe is not that God is good, but that God is so strong that it is much more judicious to call him good. It would be the exaggeration of censure to call them evolutionists, but they have something of the vital error of the evolutionary optimist. They will keep on saying that everything in the universe fits into everything else, as if there were anything comforting about a number of nasty things all fitting into each other. We shall later see how God in the great climax of the poem turns this particular argument altogether upside down. When, at the end of the poem, God enters, somewhat abruptly, is struck the sudden and splendid note which makes the thing as great as it is. All the human beings through the story, and Job especially, have been asking questions of God. A more trivial poet would have made God enter in some sense or other in order to answer the questions. By a touch truly to be called inspired, when God enters, it is to ask a number more questions on his own account. In this drama of skepticism, God himself takes up the role of skeptic. He does what all the great voices defending religion have always done. He does, for instance, what Socrates did. He turns rationalism against itself. He seems to say that if it comes to asking questions, he can ask some questions which will fling down and flatten out all conceivable human questioners. The poet, by an exquisite intuition, has made God ironically accept a kind of controversial equality with his accusers. He is willing to regard it as if it were a fair intellectual duel. "Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me." The Everlasting adopts an enormous and sardonic humility. He is quite willing to be prosecuted. He only asks for the right which every prosecuted person possesses. He asks to be allowed to cross-examine the witness for the prosecution. And he carries yet further the correctness of the legal parallel. For the first question, essentially speaking, which he asks of Job, is the question that any criminal accused by Job would be most entitled to ask. He asks Job who he is. And Job, being a man of candid intellect, takes a little time to consider, and comes to the conclusion that he does not know. This is the first great fact to notice about the speech of God, which is the culmination of the inquiry. It represents all human skeptics routed by a higher skepticism. It is this method, used sometimes by supreme and sometimes by mediocre minds, that has ever since been the logical weapon of the true mystic. Socrates, as I have said, used it when he showed that if you only allowed him enough sophistry, he could destroy all the sophists. Jesus Christ used it when he reminded the Sadducees, who could not imagine the nature of marriage in heaven, that if it came to that, they had not really imagined the nature of marriage at all. In the breakup of Christian theology in the 18th century, Butler used it when he pointed out that rationalistic arguments could be used as much against vague religion as against doctrinal religion, as much against rationalist ethics as against Christian ethics. It is the root and reason of the fact that men who have religious faith have also philosophical doubt, like Cardinal Newman, Mr. Balfour, or Mr. Malick. These are the small streams of the delta. The Book of Job is the first great cataract that creates the river. In dealing with the arrogant asserter of doubt, it is not the right method to tell him to stop doubting. It is rather the right method to tell him to go on doubting, to doubt a little more, to doubt every day newer and wilder things in the universe, until at last, by some strange enlightenment, he may begin to doubt himself. This, I say, is the first fact touching the speech, the fine inspiration by which God comes in at the end, not to answer riddles, but to propound them. The other great fact which, taken together with this one, makes the whole work religious instead of merely philosophical, is that other great surprise which makes Job suddenly satisfied with the mere presentation of something impenetrable. Verbally speaking, the enigmas of Jehovah seem darker and more desolate than the enigmas of Job. Yet Job is comfortless before the speech of Jehovah, and is comforted after it. He has been told nothing, but he feels the terrible and tingling atmosphere of something which is too good to be told. The refusal of God to explain his design is itself a burning hint of his design. The riddles of God are more satisfying than the solutions of man. Thirdly, of course, it is one of the splendid strokes that God rebukes alike the man who accused and the man who defended him, that he knocks down pessimists and optimists with the same hammer. And it is in connection with the mechanical and supercilious comforters of Job that there occurs the still deeper and finer inversion of which I have spoken. The mechanical optimist endeavors to justify the universe avowedly upon the ground that it is a rational and consecutive pattern. He points out that the fine thing about the world is that it can all be explained. That is the one point, if I may put it so, on which God, in return, is explicit to the point of violence. God says, in effect, that if there is one fine thing about the world, as far as men are concerned, it is that it cannot be explained. He insists on the inexplicableness of everything. Hath the rain a father, out of whose womb came the ice? He goes farther and insists on the positive and palpable unreason of things. Hast thou sent the rain upon the desert where no man is, and upon the wilderness where there is no man? God will make man see things, if only against the black background of non-entity. God will make Job see a startling universe, if he can only do it by making Job see an idiotic universe. To startle man, God becomes for an instant a blasphemer. One might almost say that God becomes for an instant an atheist. He unrolls before Job a long panorama of created things: the horse, the eagle, the raven, the wild ass, the peacock, the ostrich, the crocodile. He so describes each of them that it sounds like a monster walking in the sun. The whole is a sort of psalm or rhapsody of the sense of wonder. The maker of all things is astonished at the things he has himself made. This we may call the third point. Job puts forward a note of interrogation. God answers with a note of exclamation. Instead of proving to Job that it is an explicable world, he insists that it is a much stranger world than Job ever thought it was. Lastly, the poet has achieved in this speech, with that unconscious artistic accuracy found in so many of the simpler epics, another and much more delicate thing. Without once relaxing the rigid impenetrability of Jehovah in his deliberate declaration, he has contrived to let fall here and therein the metaphors, in the parenthetical imagery, sudden and splendid suggestions that the secret of God is a bright and not a sad one, semi-accidental suggestions, like light seen for an instant through the cracks of a closed door. It would be difficult to praise too highly, in a purely poetical sense, the instinctive exactitude and ease with which these more optimistic insinuations are let fall in other connections, as if the Almighty himself were scarcely aware that he was letting them out. For instance, there is that famous passage where Jehovah, with devastating sarcasm, asks Job where he was when the foundations of the world were laid, and then, as if merely fixing a date, mentions the time when the sons of God shouted for joy. One cannot help feeling, even upon this meager information, that they had something to shout about. Or again, when God is speaking of snow and hail in the mere catalogue of the physical cosmos, he speaks of them as a treasury that he has laid up against the day of battle, a hint of some huge Armageddon in which evil shall be at last overthrown. Nothing could be better, artistically speaking, than this optimism breaking through agnosticism like fiery gold round the edges of a black cloud. Those who look superficially at the barbaric origin of the epic may think it fanciful to read so much artistic significance into its casual similes or accidental phrases, but no one who is well acquainted with the great examples of semi-barbaric poetry, as in the Song of Roland or the old ballads, will fall into this mistake. No one who knows what primitive poetry is can fail to realize, while its conscious form is simple, some of its finer effects are subtle. The Iliad contrives to express the idea that Hector and Sarpedon have a certain tone or hint of sad and chivalrous resignation, not bitter enough to be called pessimism and not jovial enough to be called optimism. Homer could never have said this in elaborate words, but somehow he contrives to say it in simple words. The Song of Roland contrives to express the idea that Christianity imposes upon its heroes a paradox. A paradox of great humility in the matter of their sins, combined with great ferocity in the matter of their ideas. Of course, the Song of Roland could not say this, but it conveys this. In the same way, the Book of Job must be credited with many subtle effects which were in the author's soul without being, perhaps, in the author's mind. And of these, by far, the most important remains even yet to be stated. I do not know, and I doubt whether even scholars know, if the Book of Job had a great effect, or had any effect, upon the after-development of Jewish thought. But if it did have any effect, it may have saved them from an enormous collapse and decay. Here in this book, the question is really asked whether God invariably punishes vice with terrestrial punishment and rewards virtue with terrestrial prosperity. If the Jews had answered that question wrongly, they might have lost all their after-influence in human history. They might have sunk even down to the level of a modern well-educated society. For when once people have begun to believe that prosperity is the reward of virtue, their next calamity is obvious. If prosperity is regarded as the reward of virtue, it will be regarded as the symptom of virtue. Men will leave off the heavy task of making good men successful. They will adopt the easier task of making out successful men good. This, which has happened throughout modern commerce and journalism, is the ultimate nemesis of the wicked optimism of the comforters of Job. If the Jews could be saved from it, the Book of Job saved them. The Book of Job is chiefly remarkable, as I've insisted throughout, for the fact that it does not end in a way that is conventionally satisfactory. Job is not told that his misfortunes were due to his sins or a part of any plan for his improvement. But in the prologue, we see Job tormented, not because he was the worst of men, but because he was the best. It is the lesson of the whole work that man is most comforted by paradoxes. Here is the very darkest and strangest of the paradoxes, and it is by all human testimony the most reassuring. I need not suggest what a high and strange history awaited this paradox of the best man in the worst fortune. I need not say that in the freest and most philosophical sense there is one Old Testament figure who is truly a type, or say what is prefigured in the wounds of Job.
Why I Am a Catholic by G.K. Chesterton. From 12 Modern Apostles and Their Creeds. Printed in 1926. Reprinted in the Collected Works of G.K. Chesterton, Volume 3, by Ignatius Press, in 1990. Posted at www.chesterton.org. The difficulty of explaining why I am a Catholic is that there are 10,000 reasons, all amounting to one reason, that Catholicism is true. I could fill all my space with separate sentences, each beginning with words, "It is the only thing that," as for instance, one, "It is the only thing that really prevents a sin from being a secret." Two, "It is the only thing in which the superior cannot be superior, in the sense of supercilious." Three, "It is the only thing that frees a man from the degrading slavery of being a child of this age." Four, "It is the only thing that talks as if it were the truth, as if it were a real messenger, refusing to tamper with a real message." Five, "It is the only type of Christianity that really contains every type of man, even the respectable man." Six, "It is the only large attempt to change the world from the inside, working through wills and not laws," and so on. Or I might treat the matter personally and describe my own conversion, but I happen to have a strong feeling that this method makes the business look much smaller than it really is. Numbers of much better men have been sincerely converted to much worse religions. I would much prefer to attempt to say here of the Catholic Church precisely the things that cannot be said even of its very respectable rivals. In short, I would say chiefly of the Catholic Church that it is Catholic. I would rather try to suggest that it is not only larger than me, but larger than anything in the world, that it is indeed larger than the world. But since in this short space I can only take a section, I will consider in its capacity of a guardian of the truth. The other day, a well-known writer, otherwise quite well-informed, said that the Catholic Church is always the enemy of new ideas. It probably did not occur to him that his own remark was not exactly in the nature of a new idea. It is one of the notions that Catholics have to be continually refuting, because it is such a very old idea. Indeed, those who complain that Catholicism cannot say anything new seldom think it necessary to say anything new about Catholicism. As a matter of fact, a real study of history will show it to be curiously contrary to the fact, insofar as the ideas are really ideas, and insofar as any such ideas can be new. Catholics have continually suffered through supporting them when they were really new, when they were much too new to find any other support. The Catholic was not only the first in the field, but alone in the field, and there was as yet nobody to understand what he had found there. Thus, for instance, nearly 200 years before the Declaration of Independence and the French Revolution, in an age devoted to the pride and praise of princes, Cardinal Bellarmine and Suarez the Spaniard laid down lucidly the whole theory of democracy. But in that age of the divine right, they only produced the impression of being sophistical and sanguinary Jesuits, creeping about with daggers to the effect of the murder of kings. So again, the casuists of the Catholic school said that all that can really be said for the problem plays and the problem novels of our own time, 200 years before they were written, they said that they were really are problems of moral conduct, but they had the misfortune to say it 200 years too soon, in a time of tub-thumping fanaticism and free and easy vituperation. They merely got themselves called liars and shufflers for being psychologists before psychology was the fashion. It would be easy to give any number of other examples down to the present day, and the case of ideas that are still too new to be understood, there are passages in Pope Leo's encyclical on labor, author's note, also known as Rerum Novarum, released in 1891, which are only now beginning to be used as hints for social movements much newer than socialism. And when Mr. Belloc wrote about the servile state, he advanced an economic theory so original that hardly anybody has yet realized what it is. A few centuries hence, other people will probably repeat it, and repeat it wrong. And then, if Catholics object, their protest will be easily explained by the well-known fact that Catholics never care for new ideas. Nevertheless, the man who made that remark about Catholics meant something, and it is only fair to him to understand it rather more clearly than he stated it. What he meant was that, in the modern world, the Catholic Church is, in fact, the enemy of many influential fashions, most of which still claim to be new, though many of them are beginning to be a little stale. In other words, insofar as he meant that the Catholic Church often attacks what the world at any given moment supports, he was perfectly right. The Church does often set herself against the fashion of this world that passes away, and she has experience enough to know how very rapidly it does pass away. But to understand exactly what is involved, it is necessary to take a rather larger view and consider the ultimate nature of the ideas in question. To consider, so to speak, the idea of the idea. 9 out of 10 of what we call new ideas are simply old mistakes. The Catholic Church has, for one of her chief duties, that of preventing people from making those old mistakes, from making them over and over again forever, as people always do if they are left to themselves. The truth about the Catholic attitude towards heresy, or as some would say, towards liberty, can best be expressed perhaps by the metaphor of a map. The Catholic Church carries a sort of map of the mind which looks like the map of a maze, but which is in fact a guide to the maze. It has been compiled from knowledge which, even considered as human knowledge, is quite without any human parallel. There is no other case of one continuous intelligent institution that has been thinking about thinking for 2,000 years. Its experience naturally covers nearly all experiences, and especially nearly all errors. The result is a map in which all the blind alleys and bad roads are clearly marked. All the ways that have been shown to be worthless, by the best evidence of all evidence, the evidence of those, have gone down them. On this map of the mind, the errors are marked as exceptions. The greater part of it consists of playgrounds and happy hunting fields, where the mind may have as much liberty as it likes. Not to mention any number of intellectual battlefields in which the battle is indefinitely open and undecided, but it does definitely take the responsibility of marking certain roads as leading nowhere, leading to destruction, to a blank wall, or a sheer precipice. By this means it does prevent men from wasting their time or losing their lives upon paths that have been found futile or disastrous again and again in the past, but which might otherwise entrap travelers again and again in the future. The Church does make herself responsible for warning her people against these, and upon these the real issue of the case depends. She does dogmatically defend humanity from its worst foes, these hoary and horrible devouring monsters of old mistakes. Now, all these false issues have a way of looking quite fresh, especially to a fresh audience, to a fresh generation. Their first statement always sounds harmless and plausible. I will give only two examples. It sounds harmless to say, as most modern people have said, actions are only wrong if they are bad for society. Follow it out, and sooner or later you will have the inhumanity of a hive or a heathen city, establishing slavery as the cheapest and most certain means of production, torturing the slaves for evidence because the individual is of nothing to the state, declaring that an innocent man must die for the people, as did the murderers of Christ. Then, perhaps you will go back to Catholic definitions and find that the Church, while she also says it is our duty to work for society, says other things which also forbid individual injustice. Or again, it sounds quite pious to say, our moral conflict should end with a victory of the spiritual over the material. Follow it out, and you may end in the madness of the Manichaeans, saying that a suicide is good because it is a sacrifice, that a sexual perversion is good because it produces no life, that the devil made the sun and the moon because they are material. Then you may begin to guess why Catholicism insists that there are evil spirits as well as good, that materials also may be sacred, as in the Incarnation, or the Mass, in the sacrament of marriage, or the resurrection of the body. Now there is no other corporate mind in the world that is thus on the watch to prevent minds from going wrong. The policeman comes too late when he tries to prevent men from going wrong. The doctor comes too late, for he only comes to lock up a madman, not to advise a sane man on how not to go mad. All other sects and schools are inadequate for the purpose. This is not because each of them may not contain a truth, but precisely because each of them does contain a truth, and is content to contain a truth. None of the others really pretends to contain the truth. None of the others, that is, really pretends to be looking out in all directions at once. The Church is not merely armed against the heresies of the past, or even of the present, but equally against those of the future, that may be the exact opposite of those of the present. Catholicism is not ritualism. It may in the future be fighting some sort of superstitious and idolatrous exaggeration of ritual. Catholicism is not asceticism. It has again and again in the past repressed fanatical and cruel exaggerations of asceticism. Catholicism is not mere mysticism. It is even now defending human reason against the mere mysticism of pragmatists. Thus, when the world went Puritan in the 17th century, the Church was charged with pushing charity to the point of sophistry, with making everything easy with the laxity of the confessional. Now that the world is not going Puritan, but pagan, it is the Church that is everywhere protesting against a pagan laxity in dress or manners. It is doing what the Puritans wanted done when it is really wanted. In all probability, all that is best in Protestantism will only survive in Catholicism. And in that sense, all Catholics will still be Puritans when all Puritans are pagans. Thus, for instance, Catholicism, in a sense little understood, stands outside a quarrel like that of Darwinism at Dayton. It stands outside it because it stands all around it, as a house stands all around two incongruous pieces of furniture. It is no sectarian boast to say it is before and after and beyond all these things in all directions. It is impartial in a fight between the fundamentalist and the theory of the origin of species, because it goes back to an origin before that origin, because it is more fundamental than fundamentalism. It knows where the Bible came from. It also knows where most of the theories of evolution go to. It knows there were many other Gospels besides the four Gospels, and that the others were only eliminated by the authority of the Catholic Church. It knows there are many other evolutionary theories besides the Darwinian theory, and that the latter is quite likely to be eliminated by later science. It does not, in the conventional phrase, accept the conclusions of science, for the simple reason that science has not concluded. To conclude is to shut up, and the man of science is not at all likely to shut up. It does not, in the conventional phrase, believe what the Bible says, for the simple reason that the Bible does not say anything. You cannot put a book on the witness box and ask it what it really means. The fundamentalist controversy itself destroys fundamentalism. The Bible by itself cannot be the basis of an agreement when it is a cause of disagreement. It cannot be the common ground of Christians when some take it allegorically and some literally. The Catholic refers it to something that can say something, to the living, consistent, and continuous mind of which I have spoken, the highest mind of man, guided by God. Every moment increases for us the moral necessity for such an immortal mind. We must have something that will hold the four corners of the world still while we make our social experiments or build our utopias. For instance, we must have a final agreement, if only on the truism of human brotherhood, that will resist some reaction of human brutality. Nothing is more likely just now than that the corruption of representative government will lead to the rich breaking loose altogether and trampling on all the traditions of equality with mere pagan pride. We must have the truisms everywhere recognized as true. We must prevent mere reaction in the dreary repetition of old mistakes. We must make the intellectual world safe for democracy. But in the conditions of modern mental anarchy, neither that nor any other ideal is safe, just as Protestants appealed from priests to the Bible and did not realize that the Bible also could be questioned, so Republicans appealed to from kings to the people and did not realize that the people could be defied. There is no end to the dissolution of ideas, the destruction of all tests of truth that has become possible since men abandoned the attempt to keep a central and civilized truth to contain all truths and trace out and refute all errors. Since then, each group has taken one truth at a time and spent the time in turning it to a falsehood. We have had nothing but movements, or in other words, monomanias. But the church is not a movement, but a meeting place, the trysting place of all truths in the world. If you wish to read more fine articles by G.K. Chesterton, you can find them at www.chesterton.org. Thank you very much, and God bless you, and peace be upon you. This is Genghis Khan 44, out.